Right now it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David, of course, joins us every Friday morning live. We rebroadcast David during the week in the noontime hour, also on the weekends. David, besides doing this for us, also has his own website, themediabeat.us. You'll also find him on the Huffington Post in their commentary section. Also, he's a PBS television correspondent who reports on ethics and belief. And ladies and gentlemen, let's bring him in. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good to be brought in.
How are you feeling? Are you recovered from your Baltimorean plague?
Well, I am back in New York City after a regrettable trip to Baltimore. Not professionally disappointing, but I found myself knocked off the air for you. I was robbed of a voice by some Baltimore bug.
Oh, I like Baltimore bug.
Now it's passed through, and I think you can hear me now.
You sound perfect. You sound absolutely perfect. And I'm so happy. I know you have a topic, and just slightly before we get to it, I think the world needs a clinic in sensibility. So I'm defaulting to you. Whose job is it? I mean, is in the structure of disseminating information, whose job is it to make it not stupid? No, really, because
I don't know. Our past preceding president felt that it was incumbent upon him to make sure that distinction was made between things that were stupid and things that were not stupid, and tilt the scales towards the sensible, I suppose. He was known in the White House, and of course the quote got out because it was so striking for such a delicately articulate president as Barack Obama was. He did actually say notably and now very memorably that the basis of their policy ought to be we don't do stupid stuff is the euphemism that's used. He said something a little more forceful. But yeah, don't be stupid. It's a good policy. But who gets to decide it with the media? Oh, boy. It's a free market, let's say. For instance, I would say that, well, right now we're standing on the cusp of a news shift. I mean, the Singapore summit this week with Kim Jong-un and our own dear president, our current president, Donald J. Trump, met in Singapore, and that was the absolutely dominant news development for the week, and now being called historic and all sorts of things, but now getting shoved out of the headlines by the Department of Justice's Inspector General report on how the FBI, namely in large part specifically its then director James Comey, conducted its inquiry into the Hillary Clinton email server. And who makes those decisions? Of course, it's herd thinking sometimes. It's herd thinking with a vengeance sometimes, and other times it's just I can say it's an operation of consensus most of the time. With stock positions these days, more and more in the last 15, 20 years, being developed entirely on a partisan basis. Is it good for our side or is it good for their side? Tends to be the decision taken all too often in the newsrooms of this country.
So if I were out actually talking to people and I came in and I put my, I wrote my story. Because what I am finding is that once you get through the layers, regular people just think it's asinine. Regular, so it's
yeah,
you,
yeah,
you
sure.
know.
Well,
it's,
there's something about the hysteria of the. Oh, is that the right word? It's certainly sort of. The tone of coverage yeah. generally, especially in politics, and I suspect you are talking mostly about politics now. The volume is turned up so much now that it's hard to discern anything but emotional buttons being pressed all the time in the corridors of power, in the desks of influence, and that's what we see: a stock position being taken And yeah, of course, calm, rational, normal, ordinary people will see this as asinine. God, I hope they do.
Oh, they do. I can't say it's unscientific.
Asinine meter is required for every single one of us as consumers of media output.
But the complication, and this is why I'm curious about the literal sausage making in this instance, because the leaps that are required to just view something credibly, they're leaps that defy common sense. You know, if you're just trying to run your household and somebody leaves the water running and the kitchen floods and you come back and nobody's turned off the water and, oh, I didn't do it. No, you know, there's only one person. You handle it a certain way. You know, your mind processes that information.
Common sense. So you're asking the media to practice common sense.
No, I'm asking who's somewhat responsible for filtering some of that out, because there are a lot of people who have to function every day using common sense. And it hasn't all gone away.
Well, a lot of it is... A lot of it is endemic. A lot of it, though, I have to say, is excuse me. A lot of it is amped up by the current, and I would say it's something that's been developing over 15, 20 years. The Trump administration is not some sudden aberration, although a lot of people in the media seem to try to paint it as such. It's the almost inevitable outcome of trends in media. In information peddling or information dissemination over more than two decades now. The Singapore summit is an extraordinary example of it this week. What we had there was, I guess you've got to call it a massive piece of media manipulation perpetrated by the Trump regime, but also perpetrated by a willing conspiracy by the media themselves. It was an extraordinary piece of what is being called, certainly in one of our more august newspapers, the Washington Post, it's been called a triumph of Trumpian stagecraft. And then, this is the important qualification on that, uttered by Margaret Sullivan, who writes on the media for the Washington Post and used to be the New York Times' so-called public editor, a difference in name only from a much more traditional, 20th century traditional post in newspapers that was, first of all, called Ombudsman, following the Scandinavian practice of appointing someone to represent the public. And sure enough, Margaret Sullivan stopped trying to represent the public inside the New York Times and decided to become a much more free-ranging media commentator herself at the Washington Post. And her phrase for the Trumpian stagecraft, applied to the Trumpian stagecraft in Singapore, was "the media fell for it." Well, that's exactly what happened, because the media does fall. I mean, it's almost in its systemic makeup to fall with anything that is big, dramatic, that word historic again. We all, and you know, and I'm prone to it too. I mean, it's part of the thinking process of reporters and editors, I'm afraid to say, and that sense of who's representing the common person and common sense here starts to get very fuzzy indeed, because we're all in the same, we end up being all in the same sort of rather frenzied pot.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because I always use a Broadway image when I think, when a show is really literally on its last legs and the replacements are there and the audience is, you know it's closing. And there are very few people in the theater. It's, you know, it's great. The actors go through the motion and everything, they, you know, because it's their job and they're being paid. And, you know, some people are seeing it for the first time, etc. But the difference in energy is palpable, you know, from the beginning of a show that's a hit to its final days. It's just, you know, nature of life. It evolves. And I find it remarkable that what looks like pretty much every media outlet, irrespective of its partisan leanings, is paying so little attention to their consumer whilst complaining that their business is bad. You know, it just seems
Or irrelevant to people's real interests, or
disrespectful.
In broad sum, disrespectful and indeed distorting. I mean, this happened certainly in the media's coverage of the historic Singapore summit. It would report details in specific and incontrovertible terms, you know, this happened, this happened, this happened. But there was something about the tone, again, to quote Sullivan, breathless positivity was off-putting. And it falls, I think, to represent the voice of the common reader, it often falls to other people in the in the ecosystem of journalism to do that thing of representing common sense. Thank goodness the New York Times has inherited from its takeover of the old International Herald Tribune, and now calling it the New York Times International. But one of its great strengths was an editorial cartoonist. And since 2001, it's been Patrick Chappett. And the best comment I saw in the entire coverage of the summit, the sort of little corrective that is so necessary. Reporters would say at certain points in the story that the agreement signed, remember there was an agreement signed, was light on detail. Patrick Chappett did it rather more fully and comprehensively in only 5 words. He actually quoted Patrick Chappett quoted President Trump's favorite phrase. He focused in on a cartoon version of the final summary of the agreement, summing it up in only 5 words, on the signature page of this agreement, showing both men, either side of the agreement, with their names signed underneath the phrase, "We'll see what happens." That's the Singapore agreement. Now that's the kind of common sense journalism that it takes an awful lot to refine down to. But in the meantime, you've got to get wade through the extraordinary trumpeting and again, total acceptance of the state, largely uncritical acceptance of the stagecraft that's going on. It's not as if Donald Trump is a genius at media manipulation on the basis of his time as a so-called reality TV star. But he annoyed the hell out of NBC executives because he began to think he knew about media because he was the figurehead of
Marshall made a great call, by the way. He's got something he wants to say. Just about speaking of stagecraft, because it was something, Marshall wants to say something about one thing, but then I want him to mention, because I said, well, it wasn't structured that way. And he said, well, then it should have been.
Here's what I
was it structured? Anyway, go ahead.
But here's what I
think about this whole thing. Donald Trump acts. There's an old expression my grandmother used to have: some people step in poop and slide, other people step in poop and come up smelling roses. He could have come up smelling roses in this meeting, just by saying, "This meeting is only about breaking ice and sitting down with the North Koreans to introduce ourselves. That's it. And then we'll see where it goes from here." But no, it was built up to be such a big thing. And so many...
Building up is what he does. And always has done.
And so many little things happened to shoot it down and where it could easily be mocked. And you have magazines which never put up mocking covers. The Economist
always puts it.
But this is right off the bat. You know, Kim Jong Un. But then there's the video clip, which is absolutely amazing.
That's a good line. Uh-huh.
The video clip of President Trump meeting a general, and I thought I was watching a Monty Python clip. They both came to one another. Trump went to shake hands. The general went to salute, and then all of a sudden Trump went to salute and the general went to shake hands.
It reminded me
of the old Monty Python interview where the guy was interviewing the subject on Monty Python, and every time he'd ask the question, he'd bring the microphone back to himself, and then when the guy would answer,
we heard nothing because there was no microphone coverage of anyone.
And this is what could have been a really great opportunity into something of a sideshow carnival act.
With all due respect to everybody, each event is turned into, you know, once it's video.
Yeah, what I'm saying is the media didn't have to turn it into this. They turned it into it. The Trump administration turned this meeting into it itself.
Well, we're saying that it went along with it mostly, but it was properly and more objectively critical and sometimes more lighthearted, because sometimes that's the only escape from this appalling amplification and historicization and epic making effort by the media manipulators of authority. I mean, to find the National Security Council taking on the role of mass media manipulator by making, in effect, a four-minute movie trailer to support and introduce this summit. It was the most extraordinary exercise in actual determined efforts to, what government doesn't do this, but efforts to change the media perception of an event that's about to happen. And all done in the tones of a 4 minute, because it was a 4 minute long promo with the basso profundo narrator's voice, just like Hollywood, and given a phony name for the production company, Destiny Pictures.
Okay.
And the poor fellow who actually does own Destiny Pictures, a real entity in Hollywood, is extremely embarrassed by it, and not even as bad as anything worse that Hollywood could produce.
No, and the sort of thing that I loved, this was an Axios, where that's just, it was based on intelligence.
based on a true intelligence source. Yeah.
based on intelligence received and understood about this man. And what I find fascinating is if you ask the next question, which is, there's been limited intelligence really about what Kim Jong Un is like, and they're limited because nobody's.
Sure, and on the basis of limited, confined set of sources, the NSA believes them to be movable, pushable, nudgeable by a four-minute video mimicking Hollywood trailers. And that's exactly what Trump himself said in not exactly explaining the use of that video, but in reference to it, he said, "I thought it might make him do something." It's an interesting thought. Show someone a movie trailer and then they'll do something.
Who knows? It may
work. But I suspect those sane and common reader, common consumer might say, well, it might just as easily not work. But all you can say in the end is that presidential phrase, we'll see what happens.
So let me get back to just out of curiosity, because I don't know how much more time we've got left. But this is my question. Whose job is it? I concede that it's not being done. But whose job is it to get that information out there? It cannot simply be the person who's writing the stories, because they have to submit it to, it's got to go through legal and whatnot, you know?
So, the information, getting the information out there, by which I think you mean, how do you get that balanced sense of how best to assess this? I mean, is it really historic, or is it something that's being manipulated for our, basically to hoodwink us or to push us in a certain way towards understanding? Who discerns the wheat from the chaff, as it were? Well, of course, it's the editorial bank of a newspaper, a magazine, a television program, a website. It's the people who take responsibility for it. There used to be a phrase which meant something called editor-in-chief. And it's that person's responsibility, with, of course, the best advice immediately around them from the editorial board or whatever other deep bench they have of interpretive talent they have available to them. I fear that as all too often, a big event like this throws everyone askew. And you know, I'm pleading guilty to this myself. I found myself untypically. I normally wait for a certain amount of time before an event gets filtered through to me. I basically trust the best in the business to do their best. And sometimes that's a little unwise. I found myself turning on for the live coverage and of course, getting instantly disappointed right. and horrified by it. But right. I was swept away in the historicity, perhaps that might be the word, or the so-called historicity of the event, and I ran away from it. And that's why the herd instinct is such a dangerous aspect of our profession. It's born of the intense competition that we're in, which of course is increased ever more now, the search for eyeballs and eardrums in vast numbers, and of course the added speed at which it all happens. None of this helps the idea of discernment and the idea of putting common sense at the top of one's agenda.
You know, you say that, and I did turn it on to watch the live, the opening of it, and after 13 minutes of seeing motorcades in the waiting and blinking lights, I said to myself, okay, I'll wait and watch this tomorrow.
Yeah, that's you. I mean, again and again and again, that turns out to be the best advised policy.
So do you have time to explain how you would have presented the two?
I thought when I watched it the next morning and the initial meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, they came out sideways and met each other, okay? And they're both big men. In weight-wise, and I can say this because I'm a guy of girth, and they came out and faced one another. And, of course, Kim Jong-un is shorter, but he's still got girth. Donald Trump is taller, and he's got well-tailored suits, but he's a big guy. He's around 280, 290 pounds. That's what he says.
Yeah.
He's about 300 pounds, actually. But what I would have done had I arranged all this thing, I would have put the flags on each side, the North Korean flags on one side that he's going to enter from, the United States flags on another side, facing back on an angle so you could see them. And I would have had both leaders come in like they do at presidential press conferences from the back and walk directly to the front to podiums. That way, their weight,
full frontal, not sideways profile.
It would have looked much more official and dramatic.
And you wouldn't be going, wow, he's short.
Wow, you wouldn't
big.
Say, well,
Marshall Miles, there is a job waiting for you at the National Security Council.
But the point being, why, I always say this about me. I'm not going to say it about Marshall, but I will stand sometimes grinding my teeth going, if I can think of this, surely someone else can.
No, really, it just didn't look.
True,
it was a terrible way to start off because they looked at each other and it looked like you were going to have a sumo wrestling match. And that was
not inappropriate, I think.
Yeah, it was just plain.
But that's the visual. See, the thing is, visual, and you know this so well.
They blew so many chances to make it a significant initial meeting between two countries that have been at one another's throats, and leave it at nothing.
And now possibly at the beginning of a change in the fortunes of that relationship. And you're right, of course, what you said earlier on. Only a beginning. And of course, that was said now and again during the course of all this, but it was swamped entirely by this extraordinary enthusiasm on everybody's part for the event and the look of the event, most of all.
All right. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.